sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones. And this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Welcome back to the Church Planner Podcast. Peyton Jones here, and I am on with my friend, Dr. Michael Cooper, who has written a new book. You may know his old book, Ephesiology, which we had him on here for that because that book is excellent. You need to just get that book. But I am excited about his new book, which builds on top of that, Gods, Emperors, Philosophers, and a New Movement. A little bit about Michael. He earned a PhD in intercultural studies with a focus on religious movements and a minor in theology, focus on early Christian history from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. And I tell you that because early Christian history, that's my love language. So you had me at hello. He serves as a missiologist for East West and engages in research and equips practitioners on the field for thoughtful and effective cultural engagement. I would say that Michael is the embodiment of church plantology, where he is a practitioner in global missional praxis. He has a pretty good grasp on scripture, if you've read any of his books, but he also specializes in church history, especially early church history. He has worked all across the globe in Africa, Europe, North America, South America, South Asia, and Southeast Asia. His book, again, Gods, Emperors, Philosophers, and a New Movement. Dr. Cooper, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on, Peyton.
No, it's fantastic. You know, the first time that we ever met was on a Zoom call where I was speaking about something. You chatted, just did a DM in the middle of that call and asked me what I thought of the C. Peter Wagner quote, that the most effective form of evangelism under heaven is church planting. You asked me, what'd you think about that? And I think you could kind of tell maybe I was coming at things from a different angle. Mm. And I said, you know, I don't agree with it. And you and I struck up, and I would say a friendship from that conversation, because you're like, you know what? It's very rare I find someone who agrees with me on that. And it was great, man. It was a fantastic conversation. I learned about your book. We got you on here. And man, I'm so excited about this new book, Gods, Emperors, Philosophers, and a New Movement. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Well, it's fun to be here. Fun to still be connected. We're certainly two people in the same pod.
Yeah.
And I think that is evident even in our book titles. We love the term ology added on to the end of something.
Yeah. But you told me the trick to that, and that was you put ology on the end of something. It makes you sound smart.
Either it makes you sound smart, or it makes you sound like a cult.
Yes, and we already agreed. If we're going to start a cult, we'll do it together. We'll start the ology cult.
That's right.
The ology. It'll look like theology. So that'll make us sound even smarter.
But
it'll
be
the ology cult. Well, hey, Dr. Cooper, this book, it deals with archaeology, and I'm really fascinated about that. What drew you to archaeology rather than just engaging with the text like you did in your first book?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to share an embarrassing story. There are multiple things that actually draw me to archaeology, but really probably what the impetus was for this was one of the most embarrassing questions I had ever been asked. And it was just after Ephesiology came out, and I was on a podcast with a friend of mine who you would know, and I write about him in the book, because he asked me the question, have you ever been to Ephesus? And at that point, I had not been to Ephesus. And I was rather embarrassed about that because I wrote a book about the church in Ephesus without having even visited the ancient city. And so that challenged me to think about, you know, is there something there that if I were to go and see it, that it might help to illuminate what it was that I was studying in regards to the church in Ephesus. And so I did. About 3 or 4 years ago, Lori and I went, spent a week in Asia Minor touring around, looking at different sites. And, you know, Peyton, it was life-changing for me as a missiologist. And I thought, why had I not done this before? Now, the funny thing is I took archaeology in seminary. Part of my doctoral program was looking at Near Eastern archaeology, and I had as a professor, James Hoffmeyer, who's wow. one of the most renowned Egyptologists.
Wow.
And so I've always been interested in my undergraduate background is in architecture. So those things were, you know, a part of who I am and what I enjoy. But I just never had thought about the intersection of archaeology and missions. And
can I just ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you have a fedora and a whip by any chance?
I do not. No, I don't. Yeah.
You're more Indiana Jones than I am. That's super cool.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's been a lot of fun to do this. I'm interested in history, as you know, and especially missions history. And so that's what became compelling to me as I began to look at the archaeological record in Asia Minor, especially. And we're broadening that out now because this has become a larger research project where we're looking at archaeology in multiple sites and discovering the memory of Jesus in stone. And it has been faith-affirming. Mm. It's given us thoughts about how do we go back now and connect these cultures that are living in darkness with the Jesus who has been there for 2,000 years. Wow. And you can actually see where his story has been told. And how do we make those connections in a way that will reintroduce Jesus to these different cultures?
I love it. So for the listener, because you have a unique perspective on Ephesus, not only from your first work, from the scripture, but then now the archaeology and having been there now, could you just, for the people listening, just describe, because I've also been to Ephesus and I found it mind-blowing. Describe it for people that have never been there.
Oh, can you actually do that?
you know,
yeah, it really is. I mean, Ephesus, in terms of archaeological sites that have some biblical significance, Ephesus has to be the premier site, more so than even Jerusalem. Jerusalem, for the most part, is covered by the city itself, and so it's very hard to get a sense of what it would have been like to live there. Ephesus is completely different.
Yeah.
You walk the streets, Caretas Street, Emblas Street, Harbor Road, and you get a real sense of what it was like to live and walk in that city 2,000 mm-hmm. years ago. And that's what's fantastic about it. I mean, you go into the really magnificent Greco-Roman theater where Paul's disciples went in Acts 19 and nearly lost their lives, and the enormity of that 20,000, 22,000 seat theater is just incredible.
So when I went, Dr. Cooper, we were on a bus tour, and we went all over Paul's sites, right? And they walked us from the upper city down that, you know, there's that place where they would have the tribunals and they mm-hmm. would sacrifice the criminals down to, I think it was like the gateway between the upper and lower. And then he walked us down. And because you're faced one direction, you can't see that, you know, at a certain point, he said, okay, everybody turn around. We were just like, he wasn't hiding it from us. And I think we were focused on something else. And then we turned around and it was just there. And it, like you said, 20,000 seats. It's massive. I don't know how to describe it to everyone. It's an amphitheater.
Yeah.
And it's just there, carved into the side of the hill that you just came down. Like, it is breathtaking. It was one of the coolest experiences of my life. And to realize Paul stood there.
Yeah.
In that massive amphitheater and addressed those crowds of thousands. Like, that's crazy.
It is crazy. Yeah. Yeah. And you get a real sense. It's William Ramsey who says in one of his books writing about that area that for New Testament scholars, we need to breathe the air that the early church breathed in order to get a sense of what the early church experienced. Mm. And Ephesus is one of those places where, you know, you breathe that air and you get a real sense of what they experienced, the struggles that they had, the challenges they faced. But you also get a sense of the breadth of what it meant when Luke said every resident of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jew and Greek, and it's really amazing to do that. And every city, well, not every city. Philadelphia, you know, is one of those cities that's covered by a new city itself, but many cities, Laodicea. Is a place where you get a real sense of what it was like in the first century. Sardis, at some level, you do there as well. Smyrna is covered by a city, but you can still see a lot of the ancient ruins in the marketplace, and there's some significant things there. But yeah, it's just an amazing place to walk and experience.
So good. So the book, God's Emperors, Philosophers, and a New Movement. What would you say is the core argument of the book?
Yeah, the core argument is kind of a research agenda that we've framed. And I say we, I've taken my doctoral students with me to Asia Minor, and we've really approached this as a research project. Mm. Because our objective has been to answer this question. If there was a movement of God in the first, second, and third centuries, then what is the material evidence for that movement? I wanted at the beginning to put my hands on the evidence that's going to tell me that Christianity was here in the first, second, and third centuries. You know, after the third century, we know. You know, Constantine becomes emperor, the Roman Empire is Christianized, and so we have churches emerging and symbols emerging and so forth. But I wanted to know what was the evidence in first, second, and third century Asia Minor. And that's what we set our hearts on to find and to look for. And to our amazement, we found a ton of evidence for Christianity in those early centuries.
What in your research for this, what surprised you or challenged your assumptions about the early church based on archaeology?
Yeah, you know, it began on our first trip. We were in Laodicea walking around. And we approached what is, for the most part, a house there. It's on a road that stretches from the main Syrian road over to the northern theater, which is another one of those immense theaters that's still unexcavated. But on the left-hand side, as you're approaching that theater, you come upon a house. And the archaeologists who are excavating Laodicea have made the claim that this is an early house church. And they made that claim for two primary reasons. One is that it's now covered, but there's a mosaic in the entrance of the house that's of a fish. And we know, of course, that the fish is an early symbol for Christianity, the ichthus, Jesus Christ, God, God's Son, Savior. But in addition to that, outside of the door is what has become known as a Christogram. It's a sort of monogram for the name of Christ, where you combine the first letters of Jesus Christ, God, and you impose them on each other. And it forms this Christogram. And that was an ancient piece of graffiti that often either marked the location of where Christians gathered, or later it became an apotropaic symbol, sort of the Cairo. That's the Cairo that's on your hand there. But it becomes this apotropaic, a kind of a charm, if you will, that would ward off evil.
It's more the circle one, right? Inscribed into, and it's got it looks almost like a pizza pie.
Yep.
But that's the one that, is in, that I think this kind of is taking from.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of like son of, but, yeah, I mean, and obviously you've been to that stone, right, where it's scrawled in the, inscribed into the rock there.
Yeah, in Ephesus. Yeah, yeah, you know, yeah, there is what we've learned as we've been doing this research is that there's the tour guide version of what's happening in these places, and then there's the academic archaeological version.
Yeah. Well, I've never heard of the mosaic. I want to ask you a question because I worked with some Bible translators that were doing stuff for Bible League, and also they've just done a lot of translation work for different orgs. And I was having a conversation with them once, and they mentioned that the mosaics, interestingly, may have largely been put there by Paul's or Priscilla and Aquila's tent-making empire, so to speak, because there's an argument that the tent-makers also did murals, and murals often were done with mosaics. Mm. And so there's been a question, because that was how Paul funded most of his mission work was through Priscilla and Aquila, that they worked with their hands like Paul did as Priscilla and Aquila expanded their business to Corinth, to Ephesus, to Rome. They had homes in all three of those locations. That was pointed out by a book called Gospel Patrons. And but interestingly, I don't know if you came across that theory at all. There may not be anything to it. They may be later, but that's fascinating to me that you found a mural with that on there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was found by the archaeologists, and now it's being preserved and covered with some gravel that they haven't extracted it yet. But the significant thing about this, Peyton, and this is what was paradigm shifting for me, and something that I had to correct in what I had written in Ephesiology. In Ephesiology, I made the claim that there were 540 about house churches in the city, based on the assumption that a house church is anywhere from 10 to 25 people. So somewhere, and I think this number is probably accurate, during the time of Paul, that there were around 5,000 people who had given their lives to Christ during his ministry in Ephesus. But what I realized that coming upon this house church in Laodicea is that the meeting space in that house could easily accommodate 100, 150 people, maybe 200 people.
Wow, come on.
And that was a paradigm shift for me, because we often, even today, when we think about house church, we often think of smaller gatherings in somebody's living room. And yet in the first century, and this is an additional paradigm shift, what we began to see in the archaeological record is that the church used all sorts of different spaces for its gathering. It wasn't always the house. Sometimes it was places of business, and these Christograms could mark those places of businesses where Christians would come and gather. We have really a remarkable example of the early church. Now, this would have been probably 4th century, but using a theater space in Laodicea that would accommodate 12,000 people. And we found evidence there that Christians did use that space And so many things like this. We knew that they used philosophical halls. Of course, we see this in Ephesus with Paul's use of the Hall of Tyrannus. And other spaces as well. And so, you know, we like to talk about adaptive ecclesiology. And this is what we're seeing in the archaeological record. The church adapted the space that people were using for its purposes, whether it's house, business, theater, philosophical hall, whatever, market, even marketplace. Those spaces were adapted by Christians to come and gather. So, and I think that's significant for us as we think about church planting today. I'm now, and others have talked about this too, but we're thinking about, you know, what are those third spaces where people already gather? Yeah. And shouldn't we be in those spaces, utilizing those as places where we come and engage with people in the spaces, but also adapt those spaces for the use of the Christian gathering?
That's so good. I love it. Well, that kind of leads me to my next question, which is Ephesus, Smyrna, and Pergamum are highlighted in the book. What about those cities made them strategic for the spread of the gospel in the first century?
Ephesus is really clear about this. I mean, it does become an economic powerhouse for the area. In the first century, we know that there's a harbor there that's in use, and so trade is important. But also the religions that gathered there. You know, we know about the Temple of Artemis, but we know that there are Egyptian religions there. There's a Temple of Serapis that's back behind the library, if you remember where that was.
Literally.
A temple of Aphrodite, Dionysus. So it was a religious center as well. So economics, religion, but philosophy. You know, the Hall of Tyrannus was most likely a philosophical hall. But Ephesus was the birthplace of the Logos philosophy of Heraclitus in the 6th century BC. And of course, the early church it uses that language to connect with people, and especially John, but Paul at some level does as well, and Luke. But John, especially when he says, in the beginning was the Logos, he's making an emphatic declaration that this Logos who you have believed is in fact Christ himself. And so I think, you know, for those reasons, education, religion, economics, that city was extremely important.
So you just put a puzzle piece together for me, and that is, I did not know that about Ephesus, that it was the origin of the Logos. So knowing that John, you know, I mean, Patmos is right off the coast there. You know, the church, that's where tradition tells us he and Mary, the mother of Jesus, ended up, you know, settling down. He, in effect, kind of became almost like a network leader at a certain point there. It's pretty cool that, it's pretty cool that he's used the Logos there. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, that's apostolic agility right there, able to adapt.
Absolutely.
Like you said about ecclesiastical. So, carry on. Sorry.
No, I mean, I can go on this stuff forever because it's not only John's gospel. One of the things that I think that we've discovered in Ephesus is the identity of Theophilus. And I spend a chapter on this in the book and make the argument that Theophilus was from Ephesus, and this was an accidental, completely accidental, if not providential.
That's a newer finding. I just heard something about that on a more recent podcast where that, as far as I know, your book's quite up to date on the archaeology.
As far as I know, nobody else has made this assertion. But on our first trip, I had taken a photograph in Ephesus of the Prytanean, and the Prytanean was the religious and civic center of the city. And it kept records, archives of all of the leading civic leaders, the president of the civic and religious life of the city, different priests, the Caretes, who were the guardians of Artemis, and others. They were all kept in an archive, but that archive was inscribed on columns and walls. And so on our first trip, I had taken a picture and come across the name Theophilus, and that made me curious about, you know, could this date at that time period? And further study and research, going back there and actually being able to go into the Prytanean, which is closed off to the public, I was able to photograph all of the inscriptions there and work on translating them. And came to one that I have identified as the Theophilus of Luke. And so that's been a neat finding.
Yeah.
And curious. And, you know, I don't know how New Testament scholars are going to receive that. But what made the finding, I think, especially interesting is looking at the Gospel of Luke. And the unique material that is in that gospel that we often refer to as the L source, you know, Luke's eyewitnesses.
Yeah.
He makes a direct connection with the cultural things that are happening in Ephesus. And so that's been compelling to see that connection. But even more than that, there's this thing in archaeology that we call onosmatic congruence. And it just simply means that we're looking for places where, in inscriptions, where there might be common names that have some affiliation with biblical names. And where those names occur at the same historic time period, and there are multiple attestations to different names, that it raises the plausibility that this person was the person referred to in the biblical documents. And what we found was that not only is there the name of Theophilus, but there's the name of Trophimus, who we know is an Ephesian, and the name of Tyrannus. And they're all on the same column, and that same column dates right at the time period that Paul is in Ephesus.
Amazing.
And so it raises the plausibility that this is, in fact, who we see in the biblical record. But Peyton, what is more amazing, if it's true, is what it means as we think about how we engage culture. And this was one of those eye-opening things for me, that Luke spends 24 chapters in the gospel talking about who Jesus is. And it's telling me that we need to do our diligence as we're talking to people about the Lord, to make sure that we're not rushing through a pithy presentation, trying to get a person converted and saved and, you know, whatever, but that we really are discipling people into who Jesus is, so that they, I mean, Luke writes the gospel so that Theophilus will have certainty about these things. And it takes him 24 chapters to do that. That's important, I think, especially today where the memory of Jesus is fading, to be able to take the time to sit down with people and explain, you know, here is who he is. And this is why that's important for our lives today.
I love it. And I mean, now you've rocked my world. Like, I never considered the fact that now Luke is written to someone in Ephesus. Ephesus just, it really becomes the core epicenter of New Testament Christianity by the close of
absolutely
of of the record of the New Testament. So cool. And, you know, I absolutely love where you're taking this. You know, I've got a great love. I've got more books like Discipology. It's funny because you mentioned the time. That was the thing that shocked me the most about what Jesus did. And I think Paul really learned, you know, he came back around. He was on that learning curve. Mm-hmm. He learned the importance of time because at the beginning he wanted to go so fast, right? And he learns to slow down, even to the point of going to Ephesus for 3 years and just, you know, somewhere in between 2 and 3 and saying, I just going to camp out here and train others like Jesus did. The further he goes, it seems the more like Christ he becomes in his methodology. And like Jesus knew, hopefully that's happened to each one of us. And I think your book is one of those books that's going to help give people the framework for that. And I love, and I just want to thank you for taking the archaeology and doing what Luke did. I mean, that's what you're doing, right? Here's the evidence for you to be confident. So thanks for doing that hard work. And, you know, can't wait until you have another one come out. Hopefully there's more. Are there more, Dr. Cooper? Are we getting more?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be more. Okay. What else do you do when you get old and crusty but write books, right?
Well, okay, so I got to ask you this because this is my geek out question for you, all right? So I'm looking at your back shelf and, you know, you have to embarrass me here because I have used that book on, let's see, to you it's on the right, to me it's on the left. And I'm going to say Elwell, but I'm pretty sure that's not how you say it, right? But those books, I had a series of those, were phenomenally helpful. And I see you've got them just within reach. Far left for you now.
Well, here's Church Plantology there.
Oh, hey, look at that. We need to get you a copy of Discipology.
Yeah, right.
Oh, and you've got Schnabel back there.
Oh, yeah.
Heck yeah. Oh, where would I be without him? So I got to ask you, geek out now. Because some of our audience is vibing on this big time. They're big readers. Who have been some of the most valuable tools for you, not just in this book, but in ministry in general? If you were like, hey, these are some top tools, they may be on topic, off topic. It's just, I'm talking to an academic and a scholar here. So I got to ask this question. Who have been, and I don't care if it's devotional, I don't care if you're like, oh, it's my Matthew Henry commentary, but for our church planners out there that are building their libraries and developing a love of digging into the Bible and going deeper, what's really helped you over the years?
It's a great question. What immediately comes to mind, and this is going back to my interest in historical theology, is that I'm always finding myself going to primary sources. And when I think about, you know, the early church, first, second, third centuries, I'm going back to the apostolic fathers. And I want to know what it was that the disciples of the disciples did and what that looked like. And so I'm looking at Ignatius, especially when we're talking about Asia Minor.
Yeah.
The letters that he writes to Ephesus and Smyrna, Philadelphia, and he writes a couple others as well. They give us a pattern for what happens after the Apostle Paul leaves Ephesus. And so we see that, you know, the gospel doesn't just stay there. It spreads to Smyrna, Philadelphia, but even to cities outside of that Ignatius talks about, like Magnesia and Trellis. And those are magnificent archaeological sites that have some significant things in them that help us to grasp that Christianity was here early.
That's right.
So those are always important. I look at First Clement as well, who I don't think was written by Clement. I think it was written by the community of leaders in Rome to the community of leaders in Corinth, but still such a valuable text to understand what was happening in the early church. So those are my first inclination is always to go back to the primary sources. But outside of that, I mean, you mentioned Eckhart Schnabel. He was a colleague of mine when I was at Trinity.
What? And, you knew the great one?
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully, I don't think he's dead. I hope I still know him. But,
man, I got to interview him. I owe that guy for Plantology. I got a warning from Zonderman. Hey, you might be overquoting this guy a little bit. And I'm like, he's brilliant. I'm not an academic, you know. I mean, my stuff's like, you know, the Walmart version of, hey, let me help you understand what I know, but here's borrowed brilliance from everybody else, right?
Yeah.
But I tell you what, that guy, I would love to meet him. So
He's a neat guy for sure. But his two volumes, and he's written a popular version of these two volumes, but the big two volume set, I think, is something that should be on every church planter's shelf.
Yeah.
Because he does such a great job looking at all of the literature that is addressing the early church and, you know, through the book of Acts. And so that's an exceptional volume to have.
Well, I can tell you what books I'm going to be quoting heavily in a future book. Here's a little sneak peek for the audience, but I'll be doing Reachology, Teamology, and Hubology, which are Paul's three mission journeys. It's Plantology broken down into a, you know, what did Paul learn in this one, that one, this one. And it is a sequence, right? If you're talking to New Thing, may they rest in peace, New Thing had reproducing disciples, which I would say is discipology. Then reproducing churches, right? Reproducing leaders and reproducing networks. And that's just, you know, quite accidentally, we came to the same conclusion. I just found it from the scripture. They just looked at movements. And so, you know, it's pretty exciting that the church is getting this handle on first century mission again. And that's definitely part of my mission. I know it's yours. And you are someone I deeply respect. I was looking forward to this. By the way, I'm not taking any more podcasts between now and the fall. But when I saw this book come out, I told Brooks, we have to get him and promote this because I'm such a fan. So the book, guys, again, is Gods, Emperors, Philosophers, and a New Movement. My guest has been Michael Cooper, Dr. Michael Cooper. And I want to give you an opportunity, Dr. Cooper, if there's a way that people can get a hold of you, if there's any courses that you're running, any way that people can get more involved in ephesiology, where can they get in touch?
Yeah. Well, the book is a great place. In the book, we have a offer for a free course that is kind of an embellishment on the book itself. We go into a lot more details about some of the things that we found in the course, and that's free. And then it comes with a compendium volume that's also free. That's a visual guide. So I've taken thousands of high-resolution pictures of the different things that we were observing and put those in a volume itself. And did that primarily because as I was writing Gods, Emperors, Philosophers in a New Movement, the publisher was saying, well, if you put books on or if you put pictures in this book, it's going to double the price. And I thought, that's crazy. Who's going to buy a $60 book?
So I thought,
yeah. Well, so we put the pictures online as well as in a PDF so that you can look at the pictures as well. So that's always a great place to connect with us at masterclasses.ephesiology.com. And then I'm happy to respond to emails as well at michael@ephesiology.com.
So great. Well, it has been a pleasure to have you again. It's Gods, Emperors, Philosophers, and a New Movement. This has been my guest, Michael Cooper. I myself am Peyton Jones. This has been the Church Planter Podcast. Want to thank you for joining us. And on behalf of our audience, Michael, thank you.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
All right. Well, hey, guys, this has been Peyton Jones reminding you, if you want to reach the ones nobody's reaching, you need to go where nobody's going and do what nobody's doing.